All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with the opening up the committee. Senate Judiciary Committee is called to order. I have a number of members that are here on different bills that want to be giving testimony, so what I'm going to be doing is getting their testimony in, so we may be opening and recessing some of the bills just to make sure I can get members in and out since they have other duties that they need to go to. And so what we're going to do is we'll start at the top of the list of the bills that have members. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2274A.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2274A permits certified peace officers from adjoining states to operate as peace officers in Oregon within 50 miles of shared border in response to a request from another officer or in an emergency. It applies in the absence of a mutual aid agreement.
All right. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Bill Garrard, District 56, Southern Klamath County. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, the need for House Bill 2274 was brought to me by Brian Bechdel, a State Marshal for the City of Merrill, Oregon, who's sitting to my right. Merrill has a population of 700 residents, located just a few miles from the California state border. Brian is here with me, along with Oregon State Police Captain Steve DeVell, who's Director of Professional Standards for the State Police. He's sitting to my left. Marshal Bechdel will explain the need for the bill, and Captain DeVell will address any of the Dash 3 amendments that we're requesting that you insert into the bill. We've worked with the Sheriff's Association and with the Oregon State Police to bring you, as amended, this bill that has had no opposition, passed out of the House committee on a unanimous vote, and passed the House floor by a 58-0 vote. House Bill 2274 is a bill whose intent is very simple. With the shrinking of number of patrol and law enforcement in the state of Oregon and on Oregon's highways, this bill will help protect and serve Oregonians who live in remote and rural areas of Oregon. I believe this is a good bill, and I would ask you to move it on to the Senate for a full vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Brian, were you going to give testimony today?
Yes.
Okay, but why don't you go ahead and go next?
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, I want to thank you for hearing this today. This is actually a very high need for us in our area as well as the other outlying areas throughout the state of Oregon.
I need you to go ahead and put your name on the record, please.
Okay, I'm sorry. Brian P. Bechdel, City Marshal, Merrill, Oregon.
I hate to do this, but if you'll take your microphone and move it up. There we go.
How's that?
That's excellent.
Yeah, okay. I follow direction well. This came up actually as a result of a gang task force where we work with two counties in California and 2 to 3 counties in Oregon. And one of the problems that came that we discussed on a regular basis was the fact that we cannot cross the border between California and Oregon and still remain police officers. This is a remedy for that, as well as providing backup, which is probably the most crucial part of this. As it sits now, my town actually has 900 people in it. I'm 1 mile from the California border. Currently, the Klamath County Sheriff's Office has two deputies that work between the hours of 5 p.m. and 3 a.m. 7 days a week, and that is all of my backup. I work alone on a major highway, and my closest backup is actually Siskiyou County, Modoc County, and City of Tule Lake. They can't come and help me. If they cross the border, they're merely just a civilian. This bill will remedy that situation. If I request their assistance, if they happen to drive by and see an emergency situation, they can act as police officers until an Oregon police officer can come and take over the investigation or handle the situation. It's a no-money bill. There is no compensation given to any agency for providing these services. California currently has a bill sitting in that's going to be presented to their legislature, do the same for their neighboring states as well. So I ask you to strongly consider this.
All right, we're going to come back for questions, but let's go ahead and get the rest of the testimony in. So Steve, if you'll be so kind.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Chair Brzezinski, I'm Steve Duvall, captain with the Oregon State Police. I oversee the Professional Standards Office, which includes risk management and civil liability, which is the perspective at which I looked at this bill when it came to my attention. Did recognize some issues there with respect to some ambiguous language and indemnification issues, which I brought forth to Representative Garrard, who's very gracious in his acceptance of these suggestions, which has ultimately resulted in the Dash 3 amendments that are presented before you today. I'll be very brief. I've provided you with written testimony, but the three issues that are mentioned in the written testimony were some ambiguous language with respect to the use of the term certified peace officer. In the bill as passed the House, it seemed to read to reference both Oregon and officers from adjoining states. This amendment clarifies that language. The other issue was with respect to indemnification of civil liability. The bill as it passed out of the House was somewhat unclear as to where liability rested should an incident occur that resulted in exposure to liability. The language in the Dash 3 clears that issue up and makes it clear that it remains with the employing agency of the officer and does not transfer to an Oregon agency just by the mere fact the officer comes into Oregon to provide assistance. And the third was just a simple issue with respect to clarifying that when an officer does respond to Oregon from another state that they must submit their written reports as normal. This mirrors current language in statute that's used in mutual aid agreements. OSP is neutral on the bill, but would have no opposition at all to the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments. It does clear up our issues.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. I actually have a couple of questions. First is, we have a Dash A4 that
the sunset.
Yeah, sunset in 2016. Is that your amendment or?
That's the chair's.
Okay, so I guess I'll let the chair explain that one. Second is, is there reciprocity with California or Idaho, for instance, if our peace officers were going to help out a small town in Northern California? I mean, is that?
May I address that? It's currently being brought by local agencies in California right now to their assembly, a similar bill.
Okay. And then follow-up, tribal police. I know, obviously, Klamath is both in Oregon and California. We had a bill that would be addressing the jurisdiction of tribal police, so I'm curious if that bill passes. Do you know how that would affect their ability to, and I'm not familiar with Yurok or if they have their own tribal police as well.
We have no tribal police in Klamath County, so I wouldn't be the one to ask them. But from what I understand, they're certified in Oregon, and I'm not sure what California is. As long as the neighboring state certifies a police officer, it would fit this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, we have no objection to the Dash 4 amendments proposed by the chair, which would add, just a sunset in 4 years to the bill. So we actually think that's a good idea.
Thank you. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. In all across the southern Oregon border and a lot of Idaho border, there's a vast amount of space and not very many people, and it's a long ways between officers. And when someone calls for backup, they don't really don't care which uniform they're wearing. They'd like to have some backup. You can be in a position where you make a traffic stop, and if you could be easily 3 hours from backup, and in this case, a Tule Lake police officer might be within 30 minutes of you. And I mean, I think it's something that really needs to be done, particularly in this economic environment where law enforcement is numbers are suffering and the ability to respond is suffering. We need to be able to use whatever resources we have.
Yeah. Senator Bonamici?
Thank you. Yes, I had a question. I did.
Yeah, go ahead. I've got some comments, but I'll make
okay. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I wondered if you had any discussions in the House or along the way from any of the other jurisdictions, for example, from Representative Benz in Ontario or the other districts that have adjoining states nearby. Have they weighed in on this? Because it seems sort of focused to your area representative, but I know that it applies to others as well, and I just wondered if you had input from others who may be impacted.
Chair Pruszynski and Senator Buttigieg, the bill did pass the House floor 58-0, and the brief discussions I've had with other legislators from remote and rural areas are all in favor of this bill.
Thank you.
All right, so my comments are just as follows. The reason for the sunset clause, this is something that's going to be above and beyond what we have had. It seems only fair to make certain it's going to work. We'll be able to come back and ensure it. If it is, then we can move it forward into perpetuity. The mutual aid agreement that was discussed by the state police, I had assumed that that could be done now just between agencies, but I assume also now, because we're talking different states, it's not quite as applicable, that it may take some other type of mechanism. And so I'm assuming this is one of the reasons that we're moving forward with the bill. Is that a fair assessment?
Senator Pruszynski, I believe I can address that. This bill only applies in the absence of a mutual aid agreement.
In absence. Okay.
Yes, sir. For the state police, we have mutual aid agreements with all the adjoining states, so this does not impact Oregon State Police. And the intent of the bill, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, is to deal with those situations where there is not a mutual aid agreement already in place.
Okay. So that would make me, I just question as to why we haven't done that through a mutual aid, just to throw that out as a question. Also deputizing as to the authority of a officer within the state of Oregon being able to deputize another law enforcement officer from another state. I mean, they can in fact deputize any civilian to assist, and I'm wondering if that was ever looked at before.
The problem is that if another officer, we'll say an out-of-state officer, comes across a situation that is unfolding, an emergency situation, it is not always practical to run out, deputize them real quick, and set them forward. Personnel change, sheriffs change, there's a lot of personality issues that can go on. For instance, I deal with five agencies in Oregon and another five in California, all within a mile or two of my agency. To get everybody together and to get every attorney together to come up with mutual aid agreements in three different counties and stuff is not always practical. This would be just a very clean way of putting it.
All right. Something to your
well, comment. I had a question because my district borders Washington, and I have the I-205 bridge. And obviously, Vancouver is right across the way. That is,
yeah.
It's not a rural area, a very urban area. So I'm just curious, and I will probably have to talk to the city of Portland about if there's a pursuit. I'm not sure, you know, city of Portland police going to Vancouver, the Vancouver police would.
During an actual pursuit, there's a federal law that already covers that. That already covers jurisdictional crossing the lines. If you're in what they call a hot pursuit, you are still a law enforcement officer as you cross the border until a local officer can assume the responsibility and continue it. There's already a federal law in place on that.
Thank you.
Right. Chair Pruszynski, Senator Dingfelder, there's also an Oregon statute under the Uniform Fresh Pursuit that allows reciprocity with respect to pursuits.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there any other questions or comments? Thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2274? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. This one, Representative Gerard, I'm going to have it scheduled for work session next Tuesday, which will be May 31st.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. And so we'll close that public hearing. And we're going to go into, I've got a couple of different members here. We're going to go ahead and take open up for 2726. But before I do that, I did see Representative Thatcher was here. And which one are you? The 2797? Okay. And is there any other members that have walked in just so I know who's in the room? All right, let's go ahead and open up our public hearing on the next bill, which is House Bill 2726.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 2726A requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules establishing certification system for smoke shops, requires, excuse me, recertification every 5 years instead of annually, modifies definition of smoke shop for purposes of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act by limiting seating to 4 persons, prohibiting food and beverage, allowing smoking for sampling purposes only, and granting OHA, that's the health authority, unannounced inspection authority, creates a grandfather clause to allow existing smoke lounges to continue operating and to include those with applications pending before December 31st, 2010, whose certification process completes by July 1, 2011, allows smoke shop to change owners and to move to new location not larger than 3,500 square feet, specifies that new location larger than 2,500 square feet may not be more than 10% larger than the previous location, prohibits smoke lounges from transitioning into cigarette smoking lounges, specifies that cigarettes may not be smoked unless 75% of revenues are from cigarettes, increases violations from 2,000 to 4,000 per month, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
All right, thank you. I have two individuals that are sitting at our table, Representative Tomei and Senator Roy Montes Anderson. So I'm not sure who wants to lead on.
I think I will take the lead here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Przanski, committee members, thank you very much for allowing us to speak before you today regarding House Bill 2726. Did I say my name? I did, didn't I? Yeah. Okay, I represent House District 41. This bill modifies, as staff mentioned, this modifies the definition of a smoke shop for the purpose of clarifying the intent of the Indoor Clean Air Act. This act, which is also called the Oregon Smoke-Free Workplace Law, was passed in 2007 and prohibits smoking in all indoor workplaces with some very limited exceptions. One of these exceptions was identified as a smoke shop, which allows sampling of tobacco products. The original intent of the smoke shop exemption, as contained in the legislative record, was to allow for sampling of tobacco products in order to help customers make retail purchasing decisions. In a hearing, I think in this room, during the debate on this act, legislative intent was clear. Senator Przanski, you yourself proposed that the smoke shop exemption specifically be for business owners to help their customers decide what to buy. As Senator Walker then put it, we don't want smoke shops to become speakeasies, and we don't want anyone else to be exposed to secondhand smoke. Senator Burdick, who carried the bill on the floor, said no one will have their health jeopardized because of the presence in a public place. Well, that exemption has been taken advantage of, and now young people are being lured into and exposed to smoking and secondhand smoke, despite our best efforts in 2007. Hookah lounges. Colleagues, I traveled in Morocco and in Turkey, and occasionally I would see hookah lounges, but in 2007 we'd never heard of them here in Oregon. At least I hadn't, and I think most of us who developed this legislation. The hookah lounges now provide a nightclub-like atmosphere where customers gather to smoke sweetened flavored tobacco out of water pipes, the hookahs. Often the tobacco is candy and cocktail flavored, as you can see on the little flyers that we sent out, such as strawberry, margarita, or cotton candy. They target young people through social media by hosting parties by the name, one of them, is CEOs and Hoes. Lingerie night. This clearly was not intended when we passed this bill in 2007 as a smoke shop. After years of working to teach teens about the hazards of smoking, these new hookah lounges are undermining our efforts. In December of 2010, the Public Health Department, and I think some folks here will be talking about that, conducted an assessment of certified smoke shops to determine their compliance with the law. And they found that the air in hookah lounges contained dangerous amounts of cancer-causing chemicals and toxic gases. This poses a health hazard to smokers and lounge employees both. Because the harshness of smoke is diminished by passing through water, and it is candy-flavored, as you can see by the flyer, many smokers are unaware of the dangers of hookah smoking. Many are unaware that a typical evening in a hookah lounge, the smoker inhales as much carcinogens as smoking 100 cigarettes. That's in one evening. This bill would limit the number of patrons who may be seated in an establishment, which would help to eliminate the nightclub atmosphere in these establishments. The bill also requires that smoking be limited to product sampling, that no food or beverages be offered, sold, or allowed, and that the Oregon Health Authority set up a registration system that allows for unannounced inspections. We had much testimony from hookah business operators. They've made significant investments in their businesses that exploit the current loophole, and fairness dictates that they are allowed to continue. Colleagues, stakeholders have worked hard to craft the grandfather conditions included in this bill. Personally, I think that these can, and I hear from many of the stakeholders who think that these conditions are much too generous, that this compromise has been reached. It was a fragile alliance in working with this, as you can imagine, because we had stakeholders on both sides who wanted allowances and some who wanted to cut those allowances. This compromise has been reached, and it will stop at least the proliferation of these smoking dens. This bill would ensure that more young people are not exposed to an environment that is indeed hazardous to their health. It ensures the original intent of the Clean Air Act, and it provides businesses that are already operating or in the process of securing a license that they could stay in existence. Thank you for allowing me to speak in front of you today.
All right, thank you. Before we take Senator Mona Sanderson's testimony, I neglected at the very beginning of the meeting to give notice, because I don't want someone sitting here thinking we're going to work one of the bills today. House Bill 3166A is not ready. We're still waiting for fiscals on that. So if you're here on 3166A, it will be carried over until this next Tuesday, May 31st, because we don't have all the paperwork. Apologize for the interruption, but just let people know so they won't be sitting through this, so they don't care to sit through it.
All right. Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Mona Sanderson. I represent Gresham Trout, Deadwood Village, and Fairview, and I'm here to support House Bill 2726. You have to remember that tobacco use still remains the leading preventable cause of death in Oregon. It claims more than 7,000 lives each year, including 800 deaths per year due to secondhand smoke. Fortunately, smoking prevalence has declined steadily over the past 15 years, and now only 17% of our Oregon adults smoke. It used to be that the consumption has actually dropped 46% since 1996, and it has declined 58% among Oregon eighth graders. But there is a concern with the establishment of hookah lounges. We have an Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, and it surveys more than 20,000 teenagers. And earlier in 2010, the data indicated that the prevalence of eighth graders who indicated they smoked a cigarette in the last 30 days climbed only slightly between 2008 and 2009, from 8.6% to 9.9%. And 11th graders, the cigarette use actually dropped from 16% to 14.9%. Unfortunately, with the establishment of hookah lounges, the 8th graders' use of hookah tobacco has jumped 73%. And among 11th graders, it increased by 37%. And this upsurge was particularly dramatic among girls. So, colleagues, that's the one reason why I really feel that these sidebars have been that are indicated in House Bill 2726 is so important, because it is a preventable, it can prevent diseases or deaths in this state, and I would highly encourage you to consider this bill. I do want you to know that there are going to be some people testify, at least one person, and he actually is a person from my district, who put in an application in February. And he says that he, even though he hasn't had the application approved, he says he has invested a lot of money and has actually signed a 5-year lease. I am concerned that someone would actually invest that amount of money without having his application approved. But I do want you to hear that this is a personal story you'll hear, and of course I have concerns about that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Senator Dinkfelder?
Thank you. Thank you very much for bringing this forward, and I know you've been working hard on this for many years, and I do recall that we heard this issue last session in this same very committee. So while we were sitting here, I just did a Google search for hookah lounges in Portland, came up with 85 hits.
Yes.
In mainly the two of our districts. I do have a question, however. I was also looking to see how many other states have banned hookah lounges as part of their smoke-free acts. Do you have that information?
I don't, but somebody who comes after us may have more information regarding that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions, comments?
Well, I have a question, and either the senator or representative or maybe council can answer this. I'm still trying to figure out what the loophole is. How could they be operating if we pass the Indoor Clean Air Act to address this problem? How can hookah lounges be operating currently if you just explain what section of the bill they claim they fit under as an exemption?
Unfortunately, I don't have the bill with me. My staff is in back, and I can get it in a minute. But it had to do with the smoke shops. Right. Somehow that loophole allowed them to apply as a smoke shop. But there will be other people. Yes.
If I could supplement, yes. I don't know the section offhand either, Senator Bonamici, but that's correct. The definition of smoke shop is broad enough that they were allowed to apply for that exemption. The changes in this bill that tighten up numbers of people, et cetera,
section one, subsection
narrowing
five.
That definition.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, that says prohibits persons under 18 years of age from entering the premises under the
right,
definition.
That's true.
So you're talking about an increased use by teenagers.
Yes.
So how could that fit under that current exemption?
No, they can use, you can buy hookahs and use them personally. They don't have to go into a shop to use.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Prezanski, also, they're finding that underage kids under 18 are going into the hookah lounges.
All right, other questions or comments? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, committee.
All right, let's see. Senator Telfer, you're here. Did you want to give testimony?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. Thank you for working with me. It's hard to be in two or three places at one time. I'm here to testify on the Dash 5 amendment to House Bill 2726. Let me start out by telling you what this amendment does not do. It does not in any way inhibit or is an obstruction to what the original intent of the bill is to put a stop to hookah lounges. It in no way does anything to harm that direction of the original bill. What it does do is it allows a total of 8 existing cigar shops that are currently unrecognized as smoke shops to certify as smoke shops under the provision that they have separate ventilation systems and had such on December 31st, 2008, in accordance with building code. The other thing it does is it removes the ventilation certification by the Office of the State Fire Marshal for what is currently an unenforceable standard and inserts the language that would have certification revert back to what has been established in the building code standard. I believe you have a letter from the fire marshal's office saying that the current statute is unenforceable. They do not have a certification process for the ventilation, but the Department of Consumer Business Services has said that that standard is set in the building code, so it can be done at the local level with code inspection. A little bit of explanation. Prior to the passage of the Oregon Clean Air Act, establishments that were to allow smoking on the premises that were not standalone buildings had to follow requirements for separate HVAC systems to keep smoke from entering into other establishments and from exposing people who were not in the establishment from secondhand smoke. In other words, in order to receive certification to occupy, they had to have been inspected as having separate ventilation systems prior to 2009. According to conversations that we've had with Dr. Melvin Cohn with the Oregon Health Authority, the current cost of the Oregon Health Authority to certify smoke shops is $7,000. This is their certification of the HVAC system. It's $7,000 per smoke shop. Additionally, according to Dr. Cohn, they have certified over 50 smoke shops since 2009 and expect that annual number to double under the current law. Because HB 2726 with the Dash 5 amendments ultimately eliminates any future proliferation of smoke shops and the HVAC certification process is amended to shift the responsibility to the Building Code Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, there should be no fiscal impact by the Oregon Health Authority. Going from certifying 50 businesses down to 8 in just for the 1 year and eventually zero would in fact be a cost savings to the state. We in Oregon have 8 businesses who exist for the purpose of providing a product to their customers, and part of the service includes the ability to sample prior to purchasing. They have endured the expense and followed all the requirements to do so and to ensure that anyone who does not choose to enter their premises will not be exposed to secondhand smoke. And to reiterate what Representative Tomei just said was, fairness dictates that they should be allowed to continue. In 2009, these businesses were inadvertently omitted from the law that allows bars, smoke bars, to permit smoking without requiring they be housed in a separate building. Yet, because they do not serve alcohol, nor do they want to serve alcohol, they cannot allow sampling in their establishments. We are simply asking to amend the law so that these 8 cigar shops can go back to serving their customers and attempt to recoup some of their lost revenue. Grandfathering in these 8 shops poses absolutely no threat to the provision of this bill. Thank you for your consideration. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Telfer, thank you for your testimony. Of the 8, I know at least one of them you've told me about that's in Bend, but are the others in a place where if this amendment passed, people would be exposed because they're so close to other businesses?
Senator Prozanski, Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, they have separate HVAC systems so that they won't be exposed. The HVAC systems that are following the standard of the building code do not allow that smoke to get into other businesses, surrounding businesses. The whole intent is to move them from separate buildings into such as a mall, but has a separate HVAC system certified because it meets the building code so that the smoke does not go into other establishments.
Can I ask a follow-up?
You may.
So of the 8, are some of those in a mall?
One that I'm aware of is in a mall here in Lancaster Mall. But it, in fact, is not really part of the mall. It was a separate standalone building at one time. They built the mall around it so that it is, on one hand, a separate building, but they've been unable to get certification.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments? Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, we have a number of individuals who are here to testify. We're going to monitor our time because we have a lot of stuff that are still on our agenda, so we'll hopefully be able to get everyone in, and also hopefully everyone will use their time to, if you have written testimony, to only summarize it. And try not to over-repeat what others are saying. I'm going to first call up Phil Donovan and Mark Nelson. And we're going to, yeah, well, we'll see how they do. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the American Lung Association. Let me first just briefly state that the legislative record from 2007 was quite clear. The smoke shop exemption was intended to be about sampling and for the off-site consumption of tobacco products. What's happened with this loophole that's been exploited is that you have proliferation of businesses that are providing tobacco for on-site consumption. Since the implementation of that law, the state has certified several businesses. We have worked with the smoke shop business owners to craft an agreement. It basically does two things. One, it restores the original intent of the Indoor Clean Air Act to allow the sampling of tobacco products in retail tobacco stores. And secondly, it preserves the investment that certified smoke shops have made by allowing them to continue their businesses. A brief description of the agreement. First, it creates the grandfather clause that I referenced. As you might expect, the introduction of this legislation caused a flurry of prospective applications. What the amendment basically says is that an application has to be received by December 31, 2010, and then they have to be completely through the certification process by July 1, 2011. This was a similar agreement that was struck in 2007 related to the cigar bar grandfather clause, and that's kind of where we took our guidance from. Second, the grandfather clause allows a smoke shop to change owners. It also allows a smoke shop to move locations, but with certain conditions. I'll be happy to go into the details if you're interested. Third, the legislation directs that the Oregon Health Authority will continue to inspect smoke shops, but the legislation directs that recertification be done every 5 years instead of the current annual requirement. Fourth, the bill is amended to ensure that the smoking lounge don't morph into cigarette smoking lounges. So there's a requirement in there that says that cigarettes may not be smoked in a smoke shop unless that business is establishes 75% of its business or revenue, are from the sale of cigarettes. And fifth, violations of the law are increased from $2,000 to $4,000. There was a concern among the existing smoke shop owners that the existing fine is too small and that it doesn't do enough to discourage businesses from operating outside of the law. So that's the purpose of the increase. So our request to you is that you move the bill as is. There have been a number of amendments. Senator Telfer has referenced one. There are others that have been suggested that are unrelated to the smoke shop loophole that we're trying to address here. And we believe that additional amendments will sink the fragile agreement that we have in place. So on behalf of the American Lung Association, we ask that you move the bill as is and turn to Mr. Nelson.
Senator Przasky, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Oregon Hookah Association. This bill, as originally introduced, would have put the existing hookah lounges in Oregon out of business. In the House, there was not support for that concept, but I want to thank Phil and Representative Tomei, and also members of the House committee, for encouraging us to move forward to see if we could reach an agreement that would protect the investment made by the existing hookah owners in a way that allowed them to continue their business but not put them out of business. And we were able to reach the agreement. Phil has outlined the major components of that agreement, and we are in concurrence with the legislation that you have here today. I should say, in deference to Senator Telfer, she did come to our association to ask if these amendments were put in, would we object? And we said no, because they didn't hurt, from our point of view, that agreement. We understand the Lung Association's position on additional amendments. We also have a concern that that this bill not be put into jeopardy. There are a lot of, as you I think have heard, a lot of other interest in the whole smoking arena. But again, I want to thank the Lung Association for working with us to reach this agreement. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, do you have any idea how many current hookah lounges there are in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I believe there are about 25.
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, in January of 2010, I received, 2011, I received a list of certified smoke shops in Oregon. At that time, there were 10 hookah lounges, there were 6 cigar lounges, and there were 4 retail tobacco stores that all fit underneath the smoke shop exemption. So a total of 20. I believe there may be a few that have since been certified.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I believe there are 3 or 4 more that have been certified or are in the process or will be certified within the time frames that are here, but I'm not exactly sure.
Thank you.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I sort of a follow-up to Senator Bonamici's question, because when I did do a search on the web, came up with more than the number that are certified. So the question I have is, I'm assuming that some of these are not certified. And can you talk a little bit about, or maybe we're going to have the health authority here, but I'm assuming, Phil, you might know about the enforcement process. You know, one of the things I'm suspecting, because I do know some of these establishments that are in my district, and I think they're primarily a restaurant, and then they happen to have a lounge where people go and smoke, and I've been to those places and I've seen them. And the other is, if there are people under 18 there, I know in the statute that is prohibited. So can you talk a little bit about enforcement, especially because I do think it is very interesting, because similar to Representative Tomei, I was in Egypt a couple of years ago, and pretty much shisha is everywhere. Came back here, and all of a sudden I started saying, oh, wow, they're all over Portland as well. And so we have seen a proliferation, especially in the Portland area. My sense is that many of those aren't certified, and if you can speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Przewalski, Senator Dingfelder, first off, I'll let the health authority speak to the enforcement process, but I do want to put on the record that we believe the enforcement process is expensive, and therefore it's reducing dollars that should be made available to other activities within tobacco prevention, like cessation. One of the things, though, that you have to be mindful of is that some of those establishments are outside. They are a restaurant. They'll put up a tent. They'll put out tables. But functionally, they're outside. I know this because I have one just up the street from my home that wouldn't need certification because it's not indoor smoking. So this is related to indoor smoking. There are certainly some establishments out there that are operating without certification.
So, Mr. Chair, I would like to have, if the health authority is coming up, I would like to talk about enforcement, because the other is that we are changing the review. I'm just looking for the section. We're actually changing, you talked about it in your testimony, changing from annual to 5 years, and I'm assuming that's because of the expense. Is that correct? You did mention that, Phil, didn't you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, I did refer to that, and I would term that was a part of the agreement. There was a belief among hookah lounge owners that the annual turning over of all of their records to the agency was too invasive, and so an agreement was struck that the recertification would be extended to a 5-year period, but important to tobacco prevention community, the ability to do inspections is unfettered.
And just one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. And so the health authority does those inspections, and what I'm hearing is that money comes from the cessation program. Is that correct? Where does the money for enforcement
come
from?
Until we get the health department up here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, just to expand a little bit, one of the reasons we asked for the increase fine is because there is a proliferation of illegal hookah lounges out there that are operating without certification. And so that was one of our issues involving the negotiations.
Thank you.
All right. Nothing else. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to go ahead and call up Katrina Hedberg, who is with the Oregon Health Authority. And why don't we go ahead and bring up Chuck Tallman. And I've got room for one more. And we'll bring up Brent Gale. Katrina, why don't you go ahead and go first?
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state epidemiologist with the Oregon Health Authority, and here to provide information on House Bill 2726. As I think has already been mentioned, HB 2726 was, as it was initially introduced, is really looking at tightening the exemptions that are in the Indoor Clean Air Act. And we are strongly supportive of the Indoor Clean Air Act because, again, as Senator Mona Sanderson already said, tobacco is the leading preventable cause of death. 7,000 Oregonians die from tobacco-related causes each year. I think she didn't mention that it also contributes to $2.5 billion every year in medical care costs and lost productivity. So it does have a huge financial burden as well. So I wanted to address a couple of things. One, these hookah lounges, again, has already been mentioned. We've had a lot of success with seeing the decline in tobacco smoke among tobacco use among both adults and among youth in the state of Oregon since the inception of the tobacco prevention program. And the one area where we've seen an unfortunate increase has been in 8th and 11th graders related to hookah use. So we know that increase has happened more in those counties where hookah lounges are present compared to counties where they are not. So the concern, of course, is that people don't wake up at my age, 50, and say, I think I'll become a cigarette smoker. People start using tobacco. It is generally youth and young adults who start smoking and then potentially become lifetime users. So that's one. Again, the second piece that was already mentioned, the Indoor Clean Air Act, of course, is protecting people from secondhand smoke. And these hookah lounges, we've done studies of the air quality within these, and the smoke is very thick and very dense, and there is a huge amount of exposure, not just directly to the hookah smoke, but also in terms of secondhand smoke. So those are really the main issues that we have in support of closing or tightening some of the exemptions that are in the Indoor Clean Air Act. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the authority? Thank you. I am hopeful that you heard the discussion that just occurred up here, and if you could respond, if you have information, respond about the enforcement and the questions that I'd raised.
Yeah. Sure. So, Chair Prusansky and Senator Dingfelder. So a few things. You do, when you Google, I think that's exactly right, that there are a number of hookah lounges that they're both the indoor lounge as well as outdoor patio areas. And so there are more places where people can smoke hookah than those that have been certified. And we do find that there are some hookah lounges that are operating without certification. The way our the enforcement of this law works is that it is complaint-driven. And so depending on who is complaining to us, that that's the area that we enforce. So there are some of these hookah lounges that are potentially currently operating, perhaps hoping to get their certification applications may be in process. At this point, we have a total of 48 applications for hookah or smoke, using the smoke shop exemption.
And just to follow up, can you talk a little bit about the change? And I saw in your testimony you talked about efficiency as far as enforcement. Can you talk a little bit about the change from the annual reporting to the 5-year?
Yeah. Chair Brzezinski and Senator Dingfeld. Yes. So, you know, one of the issues, again, this is complaint-driven. I think it was already alluded to the cost. We have money in our tobacco prevention education program. It's money that's been allocated from tobacco tax, a portion of that, to go towards our program. And the program really is a comprehensive program. It includes media, quitline, local activities, coalitions, a number of things like that. So it is a comprehensive program, which in part is the reason we've seen this decline. And so there isn't, Washington State is currently in the process of discussing what they're doing with cigar bar certification and as well as smoke lounges, and are proposing $15,000 for the certification of cigar bars and $6,000 for smoke shops. That is not the case in Oregon. So again, what was alluded to earlier about the funding piece of this is that this is part of the funding that we get in general for our program and could be spent elsewhere. That said, we do believe that having this come up only every 5 years is not really a very good frequency to be seeing this, as 5 years is a big gap between times that people would submit their information to us. So we would prefer to have it be more frequent, as is in the current.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for her? All right. And you can go ahead and step down if you like.
Can I ask a quick one? Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Of the 48, sorry.
Very, like,
of the 48 applications that are pending, how many do you expect will be completed by July 1st?
So, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Bonamici, I'm not sure. Right now, we have 29 establishments that have filed for the smoke shop application on or before December 31st, 2010. So that's, 29. In addition, there's another, 19, that have applied since then. 8 have been for retail smoke shops and 40 for the smoking lounges. And of the lounges, 9 are cigar bars and 31 are hookah. You know, it's hard to say because the application process, and it's very clearly spelled out, that they have to show the amount of revenue they have from different products, et cetera. And so there's a process for this, and I can't tell you how many of those. So again, more than 29, perhaps less than 48, somewhere in there.
All right, thank you. You go ahead and step back. I've got a number of people who still want to testify on this. Because of our time with other bills that we have, I'm going to be limiting to no more than 3 minutes, and it may have to be shortened even more. So, Chuck, why don't you start off?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Tauman, T-A-U-M-A-N. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I appear here as the president of the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon, a nonprofit, statewide nonprofit anti-tobacco advocacy organization. My role among my colleagues who are in favor of the bill unamended is, as they put it, as cleanup hitter. I'm not sure that's where I sit in this order, but I did come here to answer questions that were raised by other testimony, and I can do that. And I'm, of course, happy to answer questions from the panel. There was a question, I believe, from Senator Dingfelder about other states that were involved. There are only, 35 or 36 states that have the kind of comprehensive smoke-free workplace law or Clean Indoor Air Act that Oregon has. So that's the universe that this loophole would exist. There are several states among them where that loophole has been identified, and they are working on language as we are here to close that loophole. So that helps a little bit in answering that question, but I don't have the exact numbers. I know, as Dr. Hedberg mentioned, they're dealing with that in Washington State. In Illinois, where their smoke-free workplace law is only a year old, they're already dealing with this loophole issue. The loophole language really comes from the language that is missing
in the original bill. So if you look at the original law, you'll see language of qualification for smoke shop. It's really the language that we're adding now that closes the loophole. It was, I believe, and I think most legislators certainly who were here in 2007 believe that it was an error not to have more limiting language at the time. There was a citation to Senator Prozanski's language and explanation of what the bill was intended to do at the time. Senator Telfer talked about that her amendment, proposed amendment, does not inhibit the hookah lounge or the hookah bar loophole closure. In fact, it does, because even if there are, even with the grandfathered hookah lounges, if the qualifications for the placement of those lounges are liberalized or made, the restrictions are loosened, then those hookah lounges, even though the bill, the amendment is intended to apply to eight cigar lounges, the fact is that a smoke shop is a smoke shop is a smoke shop, and those smoke shops that are operating as hookah lounges will then be able to locate in malls, the malls that are close to us where teenagers...
3 minutes has passed.
Let me just, if I could just add one last thing, and that is that we support the bill as amended. It was a deal that was struck in the House, very, very delicate and fragile. If there are amendments added, such as Senator Telfer's amendment, then the deal is broken. We've lost faith with the House, and we don't know what will happen on that end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Chairman Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, Senators, my name is Brett Gale. I live in West Lynn. I'm here on behalf of myself. I'm not being paid by anyone to be here. HB 2726A has been represented as regulating hookah shops, and it does do that. The bill was negotiated with hookah shops, and I'm reluctant to oppose it. But the bill is overly broad. It applies to more than hookah shops. It applies to all smoke shops, and that includes cigar shops. I have no interest in smoke shops, cigar shop, or cigarette shops, or hookah shops, but I do have an interest in cigar shops, and I have hundreds of acquaintances that also have an interest in having those cigar shops available. The customers of cigar shops know that cigars are being smoked and are being sold in cigar shops. We don't get accidental people going into to cigar shops. Cigar shops also pay, so be effectively, a sales tax, 50 cents per cigar sold. That is revenue to the state. Cigar shops also pay property taxes. Cigar shops provide employment. We're not talking about teenagers entering cigar shops. The average customer is male or female between 30 and 70 plus, economically and ethnically diverse. 2726A would severely restrict and probably prevent any new cigar shops from opening, because it would so damage the economics. Two elements in particular: the limitation to four people and the requirement that sampling only. If you require or limit it to sampling only, you aren't going to eliminate cigar smoking. What you're going to do is shut down the cigar shops, and then smokers will buy online. Already there's significant amount of cigars that are purchased online, avoiding the tax, avoiding the support of the local economy. I prefer to buy in the cigar shop, where I can pay the tax willingly and support the economy. Putting them out of business won't help this state. Putting another business out of business doesn't help this state. I would ask you to amend the bill to limit it to what it has been represented as applying to, and that is hookah shops. Now, I know there's some reluctance to amend the bill and send it back to the House, but I'd suggest to you the bill has to be amended anyway. It has at least one and perhaps two fatal flaws. First of all, if you go to Section 32AD, that section prevents the consumption, that's different than the current law, the consumption of any food or beverage in the shop. Now, not only would that prevent you from bringing a cup of coffee into the shop, It would outlaw employees from having a drink of water on the job. I would suggest to you we have some conflicts there with a number of employment laws in the state or rules. I haven't looked those up, but I suspect there are. Secondly, this bill is retroactive. The bill applies to those that have filed for certification. They had to have filed for certification at the end of December 2010. That's before this bill was even drafted or introduced. So I would ask you to amend this bill to limit it to hookah shops. There are other problems with this bill that will be addressed by Mark Luca, who I think will be coming up next. I would urge you, please, amend it to limit it to what it has been represented to apply to, hookah shops. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Mark Luca, Al, Aman, Rami, Tuni.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Luca, and I'm appearing on behalf of Ava Cigars and Wine here in the Lancaster Mall in Salem. We heard reference to an agreement with smoke shops, but that discussion, I should say, only included hookah shops. Cigar shops were not included in that original discussion. And as such, this bill does need an amendment, as Mr. Gale said, not only because of the restriction on any food or beverage, which would be very, very onerous for a business to try to deal with. If a customer walks in with a cup of coffee, when the inspector gets there, you know, they have to catch him in time, this sort of thing. Scaling that back to does not sell or offer food or beverage would meet the intent of the law and at the same time allow these businesses to not have an overly onerous restriction. One of the things with Ava's particular case is that it is a wine shop also and offers wine tastings occasionally about four times a year in accordance with OLCC rules. This would now be in conflict with that OLCC law. If we, again, put it something in there that allowed for licensed premises to do this, that I think it would more accurately reflect the current law. Law's intent. The current form of House Bill 2726 does nothing to help the businesses that were unintentionally harmed by the original Indoor Clean Air Act under the Attached Premises Clause. As I've testified on Senate Bill 783, Office Premises has a air handler that cleans the air about every 1.1 minutes. It is very, very effective, and no smoke can leave that premise other than through the ventilation system. Limiting to sampling and four persons arbitrarily restricts a business owner's ability to maintain a viable business and to continue to pay taxes to the state. And businesses are of varying sizes. The Portland area, more population, they may need more than four seats, where one in, say, Klamath Falls, four seats might be fine for them. So the one-size-fits-all approach doesn't really fit for smoke shops. Our shops and others are okay with the bill if it's amended to help the shops that are in limbo. And if it would separately define cigar and hookah shops, that would certainly be effective, because cigar shops don't have the nightclub atmosphere that hookah lounges do. Tobaccos are not flavored generally, and they're generally the expense of premium cigars is prohibitive to younger people. Cigar advertising, you'll see, is targeted to middle-aged men, typically, and those of a higher income bracket. Finally, cigar and hookah lounges are very different businesses, and a one-size-fits-all approach is a poor solution to the issues that House Bill 2726 tries to address. We would like to see, just in the interest of public health, something put in about the HVAC issue and require our smoke shops to have ventilation systems that comply with building codes. And also, it was very progressive of this legislature to put in an employee waiver. That's not something typically seen in other states. We'd like to see that apply not just to cigar bars, but to cigar shops as well.
Thank you. And Al?
Yes, good morning, co-chair, member of the committee. My name is Al Heyman. I'm a member of the Oregon Hookah Association, and also I own Genie Cafe up in Tiger. Due to the time given, I'll try to summarize it as fast as possible. 4 years ago when I started operating, I did call and followed the rules and laws to start my business. We have a lot of employees. We have family as well. I'm in favor of Bill 2726-A. We cannot operate in a shaky environment. We cannot hire employees. Now we're going to tell them probably 6 months later we're going to be shut down. I cannot operate in this environment whatsoever. I did invest a lot of money due to the law, which I followed. According to the SB Business Association, we have basically 56% of these small business owners accounts for small accounts for 56% of the American force workers. So if we are talking here, we're going to shut down hookah bars, nor any kind of business, I believe will be evaporating of this bill here, 2726, to come out and say a year later we might just come back and we're going to defeat it again. Therefore, we have to keep hiring, which we don't have. We run out of resources. We cannot keep going. And I'll keep it to Rami because we don't want to repeat ourselves again. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Due to the time, again, I don't want to take up a lot of your time, but I want to...
Put your name on the record, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
My name is Rami Juni. I'm the owner of Beirut Hookah Lounge and member of the Oregon Hookah Association. I'm here in support of the bill as it was amended in the House floor. And I just want to quickly repeat what Al said. Due to the time when the law was passed, we felt safe with the regulations, and we invested a lot of money in our hookah bars to comply with the law. And some of us put their life savings in them. And 2 years later, they're trying to shut us down. Basically, we're in support of the bill amended that will provide some sort of security and protection for our businesses.
All right. Thank you. Questions for any of the gentlemen?
Quickly, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lucas, you said something about a limit to only 4 people can sample at a time. But the way it looks like it says that the seating capacity is 4 people. So I'm just trying to figure out, do you have to be, I don't want to be sarcastic, but do you have to be sitting down to sample a cigar? Can't you stand up to sample a cigar?
Thank you, Senator Przanski and Senator Bonamici. Yes, you can smoke a cigar standing up. I have seen that done. However, they are the cigars generally are long and take anywhere from 30 minutes to 2.5 hours to smoke, and the flavor of the cigar changes during the time that it's smoked. So if one was to sample a cigar, they may need to stand up for 2 to 3 hours in order to sample that cigar, because as I said, the flavor does change from the time that the cigar is lit until the time that the cigar is snubbed out.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I believe Walid Talat, Raquel Bornhans. I'm sorry, that one I'm going to manage, not get that one right. So, Raquel, why don't you come up and you can correct me without me trying to butcher your name. And Walid? And is there anyone else that wanted to testify on 2726? All right. You do? Then come on up. Go ahead and get started.
Please. Sure. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Raquel Bornhans, co-director of Upstream Public Health, an organization dedicated to improving the health of all Oregonians. Like the upstream metaphor goes, we work upstream to prevent Oregonians from ending up in the expensive healthcare system in the first place. Therefore, it's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon. I'm here today because Upstream supports HB 2726A, as is, with no additional amendments. This bill, which closes a loophole in the Clean Indoor Air Act by clarifying legislative intent around the smoke shop exemption, is not a perfect bill, but it is a very good bill that resulted from negotiations, as stated earlier. Because this bill has been carefully negotiated up to this point, we will simply not support any additional amendments. It's actually a testament to a good process and a good compromise bill that the Tobacco Free Coalition of Oregon and the tobacco lobby have agreed to a compromise bill. Therefore, we request that you pass this bill as is and not support any further amendments. Hookah smokers, just like cigarette smokers, are at increased risk for many chronic diseases, including oral cancer, cancer of the esophagus, lung cancer, stomach cancer, and reduced lung function, according to the CDC. Due to the mode of smoking, including the frequency of puffing, depth of inhalation, and length of the smoking session, hookah smokers are absorbing higher concentrations of the toxins found in cigarette smoke, inhaling about 100 to 200 times the volume of smoke inhaled from a single cigarette. I feel out of breath just thinking about that. Simply put, tobacco in any form is addictive, toxic, and it is bankrupting our healthcare system. So today we need to close the loophole in order to limit the damage this activity is having on Oregonians' health and the Oregon economy. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Walid?
Hi, my name is Walid Salut, and I'm presenting Indigo Hookah. I applied for my license on February 24th. And I signed my lease for the store on January 1st. And at that time, the bill of 2726 did not exist at this time. And I did a lot of research if there's any law or any bill will be come up. And for all the information that I gathered, I didn't find any information that any bill will come up for preventing any new hookah shops from opening. I spent a lot of money on the store for remodeling and for the business, and I'm obligated for a 5-year lease to the property owner. Very much I saved a lot of money, and I put very much all what I have into this business to support myself and support my family. I've been unemployed for 1 year, and I have been trying to get off unemployment, looking for jobs. Unfortunately, I haven't found anything. So I decided to open a business so I can support my family and myself. So if this bill will get approved, very much this is going to impact on me losing all my money and still be obligated to pay the rent to the property owner.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association, and you have my written testimony in front of you. The only thing I wanted to add to this, we are officially neutral on the bill, and as submitted, we're opposed to the Dash 5 amendment, but just hearing the testimony today, I wanted to put on the record that we are opposed to the additional amendments that have been referred to this morning, very concerned about any changes to the deal that was struck. And also just very concerned about any additional amendments, particularly regarding, changing of the current law related to Oregon Clean Indoor Air Act, grandfathering other businesses, changing of standalone clauses, those types of things. So the written testimony is submitted on the Dash 5, but we are opposed to any other amendments being added to the bill.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Questions for any of the individuals? Thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2726A. And at this point, we're going to go into our work sessions. Representative Thatcher, since you're here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and open up House Bill 2797A. Purpose, I'm going to go ahead and let you have an opportunity to say comment on that, and we're going to see if we can't maybe get a little bit more comment, even though this is work session, was not scheduled for public hearing in addition to what we've already done.
Thank you. I'm Representative Kim Thatcher from Kaiser St. Paul, Newburgh, and I do appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come up and testify on the Dash 8 amendments I got just this morning, so I don't have a lot of feedback on all of the changes, but I wanted to mention a couple of things. But first, I wanted to talk about a couple weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, I was sitting here, Representative Krieger and Representative Barker were beside me, were testifying, and you made a comment that was in jest, but it was like, be careful, folks, they might be packing, and you said something along the line. It was in jest, but it does kind of reflect, I think, some, not necessarily from you, but in society, what I perceive to be an illogical fear of anyone who might be carrying a gun, when really it should be directed at the bad guys, not the law-abiding citizens. The bad guys won't care what we pass out of this building because, you know, they'll do what they want to do. The law-abiding citizens will attempt to abide by the law. The bad guys, you know, they might be trying to defend life, but they're also out there to take life. And people like me are out there trying to defend life. And as I see it, you'd be eroding at those abilities. And especially one part I want to talk about in the bill is what I would call a poison pill. And the changes would prohibit a CHL holder from carrying on school grounds, including college campuses. And it seems to me that these amendments are a solution looking for a problem. In earlier hearings on this particular concept, you heard testimony that there had not been any incidents of CHL holders causing problems in schools, or anywhere else for that matter. My question is, why are schools any different from any other public building? The only public buildings concealed carry license holders cannot carry under current Oregon law are courthouses and some federal buildings. And across the country, the trend has just been the opposite of what is being proposed in this particular amendment. When we look at college campus, there are 70 across the nation which currently allow CHL holders to carry on campus. And so far this year, 20 state legislatures have considered laws specifically allowing concealed license holders to carry on college campuses. Trend is going.
Considered it.
What's that?
They've considered, correct?
Yes.
They have not passed it, correct?
They have considered.
Thank you.
I'm not saying all of them have passed. Maybe some have had. But the point is, there's a push towards allowing and opening this up rather than closing it down like we're seeking to do here. My frustration on the gun bills that we've been talking about this session is the rhetoric, I guess, used by some people that cloud the issues by lumping in law-abiding CHL holders with the bad guys. It needs to be outlined and a distinction, and I think it's being further clouded with this amendment. Bans like the ones proposed in this amendment are not going to stop criminals from getting guns, and it's not going to stop them from coming onto school grounds and doing harm, if that's really what they want to do. But you will be taking away, once again, that ability for law-abiding citizens to defend life and preserve it. And just a comment about the process. House Bill 2796, or 97, we've been talking about 96 for so long, fixes a technical loophole in Oregon law that would help hundreds of thousands of Oregonians to ride ATVs, snowmobiles, and motorcycles. It was a very simple, unopposed bill. 58 members of the Oregon House, nobody opposed it. They all voted in support. Two were absent that day, on the day it went across the floor. But by amending the bill with this particular poison pill, especially one about schools, you'll essentially be killing any chance of concurrence in the House, and it would likely die in a conference committee if the supporters of this amendment do insist on pushing this forward. And I think that would be sad for all the people who have worked really hard to get to this point. I know that if the supporters of these amendments are serious about the issue, they should have drafted their own bill at the beginning of session and asked for hearings on the issue of guns in schools rather than taking this perfectly good, very harmless fix in technicalities in the law. And I know that if this bill goes forward with these amendments, that it will be sending a bad message to Oregon citizens, and I think it would be a sad day for Oregon gun owners, though I want to say I do appreciate the addition of protecting the privacy of CHL holders into this particular amendment, and I know that at the end of the day, you're going to do whatever you're going to do, but I would be remiss if I did not urge you to reject these amendments. Thank you.
Hang on one second. Questions, comments?
Just. Thank you for staying long enough to testify this morning. I would wish to be associated with your comments.
All right, let me ask you a question, Representative Thatcher. Do you believe murderers should have the right to restore the gun rights?
You know, I can't imagine that there's a whole list of murderers getting their gun rights back.
Do you think they should or shouldn't be able to apply for their gun rights back?
Do I think they should be able to apply for their gun rights back? It depends on the situation, I suppose. It depends on if they're convicted. I mean, it depends on a lot of things. There's some federal law issues that aren't being dealt with here. I don't think you can even ask for to get your gun rights restored under federal law until a certain amount of time has passed. If you're a murderer, and you're probably in prison, and I doubt that you would be able to get your gun rights back.
You know, currently under our law in Oregon, anyone that, even if they're actually still in prison, or just walked out of prison, can actually now apply for getting their gun rights back. So that's why I asked the question. One other, rapist, do you think rapists should be able to apply to get their gun rights back?
I suppose they can apply. I doubt it would happen. I doubt they would get them restored under current Oregon law.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just if I could respond to that briefly. No, vehicular homicide is murder. It has nothing to do with carrying a gun.
And rapist?
I didn't address rapist. I said the vehicular homicide.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just did not have a chance to analyze every bit of the bill. I just wanted to talk about the one part that
I appreciate
talked
that.
About. Thank you very much for your time.
All right. So since we now have opened the work session on 2797, why don't you go ahead and give us the review on the amendments.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2797A, Representative Thatcher, of course, summarized the original content, allowing person on motorcycles and all-terrain vehicles to have possessed weapons under certain conditions. The Dash A8 amendment adds, and it doesn't replace, but adds a prohibition on disclosure information regarding applicants for and holders of concealed handgun licenses under public records laws, unless it's from one public body to another for a criminal justice purpose or pursuant to a court order or with the subject's consent. It prohibits reinstatement of gun rights for those convicted of person felonies involving a firearm or deadly weapon, for those convicted of crimes requiring imposition of a minimum mandatory sentence, and for 3 years after the end of jurisdiction for other convicted felons. Excuse me, applies a prohibition to other jurisdictions' equivalent crimes, allows persons adjudicated as juveniles to seek reinstatement of gun rights upon the end of jurisdiction, creates a Class C felony for intentional possession of a firearm or other instrument used as a deadly weapon on school grounds, allowing for all existing statutory exemptions, that's for law enforcement, military, or other persons who are duly authorized, except as to concealed handguns, creates two offense-specific exceptions, allowing otherwise lawful possession of an unloaded firearm in a locked motor vehicle and otherwise lawful concealed handgun on the licensee's person while in a motor vehicle, defines school grounds and makes provisions regarding reinstatement and provisions creating the new crime retroactive, requires a report by December 31st, 2011 from the Department of State Police on Oregon's compliance with PL 110-180, declares an emergency as an effective on passage.
All right. We have about 15 minutes or so before we have an informational hearing we need to get in. What I'm going to go ahead and do, I know there are some individuals here, such as Mr. Sterrick, Mr. Harder, and a few others that may want to give some comment on the amendment that's just been read. I'm willing to entertain some of that. If someone wants to come forward, it will be limited just because I'm not sure how many people might want to. In fact, let me just do this. Given the opportunity, knowing we have about 15 minutes, are there individuals who would like to make some comment, a limited amount? Mr. Sterrick, why don't you come on up? Rod, did you want to come forward for your association? I've wanted to do those two since they do represent a number of individuals in this state. And come on up, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association. I looked at the amendments first thing this morning after I received them, and we're opposed to any of the amendments except 2787's inclusion in there. I think that would be a good thing. The rest of them we object to.
Did the co-chairs not share those amendments with you, both you and Mr. Sterrick, about a week and a half ago when I made them available? They told me they were going to share them with you.
No.
Okay. Thank you for putting that on the record.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Obviously, any amendment that would ban lawful carry on schools and college property, we believe, is a very, very bad idea and will, as Representative Thatcher pointed out, kill this bill, which I think everyone agrees. I know you and I have discussed this problem with the motorcycle issue for several years now. I think it would be a mistake to continue to have motorcycle and ATV and snowmobile riders in a legal limbo in order to prevent other people from having the right to lawfully carry on school property.
All right, thank you.
Sir, if you give us your name first.
Yes, my name is Sam Hochberg. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been practicing 27 years, and I've represented a number of motorcyclists over the years and assisted a little bit in some small ways in helping draft this. The problem is that there is no clear law for motorcyclists in Oregon who don't have concealed carry permits to simply transport firearms for whatever purpose. ATV people out who have ranches, motorcyclists, snowmobilers, hunting. There isn't a clear way to transport handguns. And so if they are to be transported, and it's up to the opinion of the officer whether under current law it's the weapon is accessible to the operator of the vehicle. How do you define that? What, do your saddlebags have latches on them? Do they have locks on them? Well, we proposed a simple common sense bill. I'd hate to see it get lost in the flurry of amendments. The only amendment I personally would also support is the privacy amendment for concealed carry holders. It makes no sense to disclose that. The very people who apply for those do so because they feel some need to protect themselves, and then turning around and exposing their name and address and phone number to the world would make no sense. That's all I have. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Right, just for clarification, I'm just to let you know that the amendment does include both the records for the concealed applicant and holder of a concealed weapons permit. That would be covered. That's exactly the same as it was in the bill. That brought it across from the House, and the ATV is exactly the same. There are those other two other amendments regarding when or whether a felon will be able to attempt to restore their rights back, and the part about the schools. So just to let you know, there are basically four components, plus there's a fix that's currently a jeopardy issue regarding federal statutes that can be charged under the state as well.
I'm familiar, Chairman Przanski, with the bills regarding the restoration of firearms rights. I represented a gentleman in just that situation who was convicted of armed robbery 38 years ago, is in a wheelchair now, and has had no convictions ever since, and he was forbidden for life to ever possess again. It's a perfect example of the sort of person who ought to be entitled to restoration of firearms rights. So the law, as written, I think is very good. I'd hate to see changes to it. That's just from my own perspective, from having represented somebody for that.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's see. I saw someone else put their hand up. Why don't you come on up? And yes, ma'am. You too.
Senator Przanski and Senators, Chair Przanski, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Penny Okamoto. I'm the Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. I'm going to try to be very brief. I have a couple questions about this. First of all, I'm not sure what is going to happen under Section 5 of this bill with minors who are convicted, misdemeanor with violence. Not sure how that would affect people who are gang members. I sit on the Gang Violence Task Force in Portland every other Friday, and so I hear a lot of that, so we have concerns about that. I'm not sure why Section 13 is included. That would repeal 166.380, which would prevent police officers from examining a weapon of someone who's in a public place. I just don't understand the reason behind that. I'd be interested to know. I also believe that private schools are not included in this. So if a private school request that people do not carry concealed weapons, and someone does that, I believe it's just a trespassing violation, where a public school would become a Class C felony. I could be wrong about that, but I'm concerned about that. Representative Thatcher had mentioned that concealed carry holders have not committed crimes in schools. That's not true. We presented testimony previously. Three incidents have occurred of concealed carry weapon holders committing shootings at schools since 2007. I applaud that the bill has a section banning concealed carry weapons in schools. And I think that we should definitely ban concealed carry weapons in schools. People are concerned about what kind of message we're sending to our concealed weapon holders. What kind of message are we giving to our teachers and our students if we don't ban this? We need to show them complete respect on this. Also, as far as the felonies are concerned, we wish that it would be more than 3 years that people have to wait. We do have some concerns about this. We do wish that it would be longer, but it certainly is better than right now, where a felon can get out of prison and ask for his or her relief to have the weapons returned. And as far as secrecy is concerned, there's already a law concerning secrecy and allowing people to actually request that. In fact, even I have a copy. I'm sorry, I did not think I'd be giving testimony, so I don't think I have a copy of this with me to give you.
I just wanted you to comment on the amendments. We're not taking new testimony on the other part.
Okay, thank you very much. So the secrecy really is already provided for people. Union County provides that, and this bill would actually effectively exempt sheriffs from audits of their official duties of handing out concealed handgun license. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, ma'am.
Hi. Thank you again, Senator, and committee for allowing me to speak again. My name is Eileen Smith. I'm in Salem. One of the questions came up with states and concealed carry on campus. 24 states expressly prohibit concealed carry on campus, means 26 do allow concealed carry on campus. So there are more states that do than don't. I do not want to see anyone openly, illegally concealing, carrying on campus. Those that have a permit are not the people that we are fearful of. I reiterate that there's been a lot of emotion. And I'd like to reiterate Representative Kim's, Thatcher's testimony.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the ceasefire, Oregon, the three examples that you had cited, we researched that online to some extent, and we could find no record of that, of any one of those three. I wonder if you could be so kind as to provide the information to this committee where we can find that information and corroborate.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Whitsett, that actually has been included in previous testimony. I would be very happy to provide you with that directly.
Thank you.
And please resubmit it to the COLT committee so everyone can get it, as Senator Whitsett asked.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and go ahead and take a motion on the dash 8s for House Bill 2797A at this time.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the dash 8s into House Bill. Is it 2797A.
Senator Dingfelder moves the dash 8 amendments into House Bill 2797A. Discussion. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to oppose this. The problem is the House sent us three very straightforward, very simple bills that we should have moved as they were. What we're doing now is legislative hijinks, and this is not the way this process is supposed to work. I agree with Representative Thatcher. If you wanted these other provisions, you should have run them as their own bills, not try to tag on to what was good bills. And you are, in essence, prohibiting us from getting good legislation passed by doing this.
All right. Other comments?
Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the amendment, although there's parts of it I don't support. Overall, I think in the balance, there's enough to support there, so I'll be supporting the amendments, although I don't support all of the concepts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll just say ditto.
All right, thank you. Has anyone said anything? All right, colleagues, the reason this has come forward in this way, I believe that in the way of trying to work anything that's, let's say, volatile as an issue regarding guns, is to have a compromise. I believe the compromise is fair,
and reasonable. It does, in fact, provide for two of the three bills that came to our committee intact, and it also provides for some individuals and many individuals. In fact, the polling clearly shows that the vast majority of Oregonians do not believe that guns on campuses is appropriate. And also many individuals and many of the individuals that have contacted me representing various their own interests as well as various gun groups believe that certain felons should be prohibited. Up until 2 years ago, no felon was able to get their gun rights back within the state. When we attempted to work through that, unfortunately, it became much broader to the point of where individuals who commit felonies with a firearm and or a dangerous weapon are able to apply for the gun rights back. The policy here, I believe, is one that's fair, reasonable, and will allow the vast majority of felons to actually be able to restore their rights back, but not those who have caused violence, caused injuries, caused death by use of a firearm or dangerous weapons. Same with the areas of mandatory minimum sentences such as Measure 11, they are also will be prohibited. The mental health issue, we will be getting a report from the state police as to their prospect as to where they're at on a funding grant that they're working under to determine and gather data that is not currently being gathered that will actually go into the federal system for NICS. And it's my belief that once we have established those databases that the feds currently do not use, then it will be more ripe to look at whether we should continue to use the current system of gun checks or should we consider going to a federal system once we know that individuals who are outside of the state are going to be held to the same standard that Oregonians are required to be held at based on the 8 databases that our state uses versus what is currently available in the federal system. So with that, an objection to the motion that's before us, please.
Mr. Chair, one more comment, if I could.
You may.
If compromise is what you're after, I would suggest that two of the bills that came from the House had over 40 votes, and this particular bill was unanimous. Compromise wasn't necessary. It was already reached before the bills reached us.
But since you're a bicameral position, I take a different position, as many individuals do. I appreciate the work they did at the House. This is now the Senate taking action, and we can always, if necessary, and want to, go through a conference committee and see what other, quote-unquote, compromise there may be. Other comments? Senator Wissett.
Thank you. I just take some exception to your characterization of these three standalone bills as being volatile. They're pretty, in my opinion, pretty much common sense bills. The volatility is introduced by the amendments, not the original bills.
Appreciate that. All right. Any other comments?
Just Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a brief comment about the process that frequently we amend bills in another chamber. In fact, we spent a lot of this morning talking about amending a bill that came from the other chamber. And so I don't think it's unusual to amend bills that come from the other chamber. It's just part of the process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. All right. The motion before us is to move House Bill 2797A. I'm getting ready to say that. With adopting the amendment on the dash 8 into 2797A. Any objections to the adoption of the amendment? Show Senator Wissett and Senator Cruz. Motion carries. Chair will take another motion.
Mr. Chair, I move 2797A as adopted with the dash 8 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Right, Senator Dingfelder now moves House Bill 2797A to the floor as amended by the A8s with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, the same concern is that the bill now would contain provisions that I do not support, but overall I support. I believe that there's more beneficial policy than detrimental, so I'll support the bill.
All right. Objections to the motion. Senator Wissett and Senator Cruz are objections.
Mr. Chair, I would serve notice of a possible minority report.
Maybe I need to put the gavel down, then you can
go ahead
and do that. All right. And we'll go ahead, and the motion is adopted. And Senator Wissett
and Senator Cruz serve notice of minority report.
All right, Senator Wissett, Senator Cruz serve notice of possible minority report, and we'll close the work session.
Chair, a definite minority report.
Okay, that's cool. On 2797A. Now we're going to go back up, and we're going to open up a work session.
We need a carrier, and I am not.
I'll carry it with the chair. Guarantee you. Absolutely. All right, so now we're going to go back up, and let's see. Open up a work session on House Bill 2726A.
House Bill 2726A, we just heard this morning, it's the requiring the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules to establish a certification system for smoke shops. There's a minimal revenue impact on the A version and a fiscal statement issued on the A version.
All right, the chair would entertain a motion on House Bill 2726A.
Chair, I move House Bill 2726A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2726A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Senator Cruz? And we'll go ahead and motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I'll volunteer to carry that.
Well, I'm going to let Senator Laurie Moniz Anderson be the chief carrier, and you can be the backup carrier if necessary.
Right.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2726A. And let's see. And now we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2662A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2662A was previously heard on May 19th. It has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued on both the A and the dash A2. The dash A2 is the amendment that we were waiting for on the previous date that resolves a conflict with Senate Bill 390. And just for purposes of reminding everyone, that was a Judicial Department bill in anticipation of e-court that touched on some of the same statutory language as House Bill 2662. So that's what the amendments serve the purpose of, resolving the conflict.
All right. Chair will take a motion on House Bill 2662A.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2662A.
All right. Senator Cruz moves the A2 amendments into House Bill 2662A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2662A as amended by the A2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2662A to the floor as amended by the A2s with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I apologize. I didn't see your hand go up. Senator Wissett should be registered as objecting to the motion. It still passes. And let's see. Senator Bonamici, did you want to carry this one? Or if not, I will do it. Chair will carry 2662A to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2662A. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2678.
Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2678 was previously heard on the 5th of May. It has no revenue impact, minimal fiscal on the original and on the dash ones. The dash one amendment removes the emergency clause. This is the measure that increases the bad check fee from $25 to $35.
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2678.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2678. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2678 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2678 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still have some concerns about this bill. However, I'm going to support it because it's my understanding that many of the institutions are charging more than $25 I'm concerned about the impact on small businesses to have to pay that fee to the financial institution and not be able to recover it. I know it's a very difficult time for consumers. Hopefully there'll be some other way somehow that we can address the disparity in fees that the financial institutions are charging. I don't think this is the bill in which to do that. So I'm going to support the bill with some hesitation, but believe that it would hurt small businesses to not be able to recover that additional money they lose when it's shutdowns.
All right, thank you. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, as a small business owner, let me say that, this adjustment is appropriate, and, I support it.
All right. And Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no vote for now because I am concerned about the impact on low-income Oregonians that I think this is not the right time, and I'm concerned about that impact because right now we have people who are really hurting out there, and I don't think that's the right time to raise that charge.
All right. So the last thing I will say, we did get provided, at least I did not think we got this in committee from Mr. Marquis on the Oregon Collectors Association that shows how much a retailer actually has to pay when a check is dishonored. It ranges from as low on this list here, $10, up to $34. Clearly, many of these individuals that that actually have a check that bounces, it costs them more than to do it. So with that, I believe the motion carries with Senator Dingfelder objecting at this point, voting no. And so we'll close the work session on that. And as a carrier, Senator Cruz, you want to carry this one? Senator Cruz will be our carrier on 2678. All right, what I'm going to do now is go ahead and open up an informational hearing. This is to allow for getting some understanding as to a proposal that has been brought forward that's still under work. I understand that. Gentlemen, why don't y'all come on up. This is the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And really what we're looking for is more of this, let's call it 25,000-foot level. I know that CJC is still working on numbers. But we're trying to get clarification as to exactly what, how this plan would play out in the different tiers. If it depends on the amount of money, etc. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We'll get right to the heart of the information. I'll just do a little opening here. My name is Walt Begla. I'm a Marin County District Attorney and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm joined by my colleagues, Mr. Jason Carlisle, Linn County District Attorney, and Elizabeth Cushwa, the Executive Director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We do appreciate this opportunity to kind of share some ideas. The backdrop for this has been clear. Oregon faces a daunting financial challenge, and so we appreciate and recognize the challenges you're facing. Our intent today is to really identify a potential resource as a means to address this financial challenge. Over the last couple months, we've labored together, and I mean collectively in this building, looking at different ideas. All of them have translated into very difficult choices to be made. And throughout that conversation, we've held closely a couple things. One, is this concept going to save money? Two, is it going to protect infrastructure, and can we retain balance in public safety? And three, how does it impact our public safety partners if this idea is implemented? So one concept that we have looked at as an association, as district attorneys, relates to the foundation of sentencing under Oregon law, which is the sentencing guideline grid. This is the tool that across Oregon we use in every county to do sentencing. So before I turn it over to Jason Carlisle, who speaks very clearly to the concept, I want the committee to know that we are very committed to be part of a comprehensive interim conversation of the broad sentencing structures that includes Measure 11, repeat offender, sentencing guidelines, all those different pieces, and looking at those fundamentals. This concept is for right here, right now, this biennium, temporary, looking at those potential financial returns because of the challenge we face. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Carlisle.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Jason Carlisle speaking. The genesis for this idea goes clear back to when the state of Oregon originally adopted the sentencing guidelines as the way in which we determine what a sentence would be for a person convicted of a crime. In fact, those of us who practice carry this little chart, and it's, dare I say, almost biblical in importance to us, because
when we look at this chart and under the guidelines, we know what the case is worth and we know what the sentence is going to be. The guidelines were developed with two foundational principles. Number one, what I just said, you can tell what a case is worth. Truth in sentencing is a little broad and a little vague, but when you walk out of the courtroom, the public, the judge, the victim knows what this person is going to get. That's an important principle to us. The guidelines were also developed in a way that will acknowledge the resources that we have available to us. So with that in mind, in order to figure out how can we save some money now in this upcoming biennium, our proposal is to take crimes that are committed on or after July 1, or to save more money, we could have it for sentencings on or after July 1. And in the grid blocks 5A through B, 6A through D, 7A through E, and 8A through I, we could simply reduce the amount of time a person is going to do in DOC and thereby save the money. It's clean, it's clear, and it's understandable. We would also keep it relatively policy neutral because we exclude the various minimum sentences that, let me back up one step. Since we had guidelines, it was pretty simple and clear. Since then, for a whole lot of reasons which I won't belabor today, we've had one layer after another put on top of the guidelines. We're trying to stay away from that trouble and those complicators. So this proposal would apply only to pure guideline sentences. It would not apply to Measure 11 sentences, would not apply to repeat property offender, any minimum sentences it doesn't apply to. It applies just to pure guideline sentences. And that's the short and the long of it, Senator.
All right, let me ask some questions because Jason and Walt, of course, Walt has been part of the group. We have had an ongoing work group, or I should say ongoing, it's ended its work a couple of weeks ago, for the public safety looking at money. Elizabeth Couchois has shared this information that you've just presented to the committee, and basically with a guesstimation, understanding we don't have the numbers yet,
right,
but maybe up to $10 million in savings. My understanding is we need to be closer to $35 million. I've heard from Senator Winters it may be closer to $40 million. So I'm trying to figure out how this plays in as an alternative or as a supplement to the other areas that this work group has worked, including the suspension of ongoing suspension of Measure 57, the 3508/1007 extension for 2 years, stuff that we in this group, well, some of the stuff that Ben agreed to. I'm just trying to figure out, is this a supplemental or is this a complete overhaul of what that group had done?
Could I yield to Ms. Couchois for that, Senator?
Yeah.
Senator Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Couchois. Senator, in response to your question, purely, this informational hearing was designed to talk about this concept. Be happy to expound upon that. What we did when we asked to work with the Criminal Justice Commission as well, we asked them, you know, how do we use this idea to get to $10 million? It was a ballpark figure that we used. There were, as the senator mentioned, we've been in conversations and at the table for months on this public safety work group trying to decide how to get to a dollar figure. And I think the problem I think that all of the members of the committee have had, as well as all of the participants at the table, is that no one has known what the number is yet. What we have seen is a lot of smaller policies that don't yield quite the dollar savings that we would hope to see in something like this. And the reason that we chose this particular idea is that it's clean, it's simple. It would be able, with any luck, and we'll find out when the commission comes through with their numbers, be able to do this in lieu of many smaller concepts that were proffered in front of the committee that may not net the dollar savings the state is looking for. The district attorneys feel that whatever we can support has to really work into our values, including the fact that justice and public safety and public confidence in the criminal justice system requires some some holding offenders accountable and have some truth and transparency in sentencing, including the protection of victims' rights and honoring the sacrifices that have been made by victims, including a balanced approach to the criminal justice system and working with all of our public safety partners and our community partners. So we're viewing every concept that has been brought through those lenses. So there, to that end, there are some concepts that we are less comfortable with than others. This is a concept that we have thought long and hard about, and you can understand that some of these ideas are difficult to achieve consensus around, and our association has indeed achieved complete consensus around using the grid, a resource management tool, as exactly what we need. It's a population management tool, it's a financial management tool, and to continue to use it as a financial management tool in this time. In terms of the other conversation, Senator, I think until we get to the point where somebody knows whether it's 10 or 40, trying to accept one or more of these options, you know, obviously we have an idea of things that are more acceptable and less acceptable, and I'm hesitant to go on the record until we know what the number is.
Well, let me ask one other question because we are going to run out of time. That work group put forward in the last, my understanding and what I walked away from it was that Measure 57 would continue its suspension. Part of the process of that was to lower the population of those that would be potential for reentry programs such as under 416. And so I'm curious as to, are you as an association saying we want to put that back on the table, that we're not comfortable with what that group had left, at least my understanding as it pertained to continuing the suspension of 57, understanding that we're trying to build up the infrastructure to have a reentry program that would limit the number of individuals that would be eligible for the reentry programs, and then having grants that were going to be available through CJC for those 4 to 6 counties to actually build that infrastructure to have a policy program going forward in the future.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've participated a lot in that work group and many of the different conversations, and I'll, with all due respect, with respect to 57, I don't think our association has ever said that we're willing to take that off the equation of the total picture. Now, what I can speak to is our efforts to look at that balance that you're speaking to, particularly with reentry, and also the conversations about stopping the entry point into prison around the concepts in 416. And one thing that I know I spoke very, very clearly about is we feel a balance is appropriate, and that if we get to a point where those numbers could work, we would want 57 in its 80% form to come back alongside those departures of those property offenders going into prison and reach a balance within public safety that would basically be the hydraulics to make sure we're taking care of career property offenses, but also doing good treatment at a local community level and also saving some bucks at the Department of Corrections. So that's where I think I have spoke fairly clearly, and I just wanted to get those comments to you.
I appreciate that. Walt, have you or Jason, have either of you been able to see the release from the FBI as to the property crime rates being down, and the comment that they said that even though we have actually had the suspension in place for Measure 57, we have in fact actually kept that crime rate lower or down? I'm wondering if you've seen that, because if not, I'll be sure to get that information. I assume you've got it from the CJC.
Mr. Chair, I've seen the anecdotally in the paper, and it's really encouraging to see those particular numbers, but I haven't seen the exact data. We have a Criminal Justice Commission meeting today, I think. I don't know if we're going to be discussing those. But
I will try to make certain that that information gets to you, because I was pretty impressed that they actually identified that when we went with the suspension on 57, that we were still able to maintain or the lower rate of offenders in property crimes. All right, I've held my committee here for about 4 minutes over. Did anyone have comments?
I have just one question. How does this scheme here, how does this fit in with like the other bills that are in still in the pipeline about earned time, federal earned time, and state earned time? I forget the acronym now, in the prison system where they have a enhanced training program that allows them to get out of the AIP. Would this be supplementary to that, or would this be in lieu of that, or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, this concept is the, we believe, if with the numbers are there, it's a financial system, this will be the primary concept that will allow us to take some of those other concepts off the table. That would be my approach here, is that this is the most transparent, upfront guideline from all of Oregon on how we sentence defendants and criminals. And this would be, if it came forward in a meaningful financial way, would be that primary tool, and that we could take some of those more difficult, actually damaging concepts off the table and utilize this. So that's what we hope to bring forward to these, to your colleagues.
Thank you. Now, before we can close for the day, I want to make sure I've covered everything, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Based on my record, Christy, correct me if I'm wrong, we are carried over to May 31st, which is next Tuesday, the following bills: House Bill 2274A, House Bill 3166A. We've already taken, with those being carried over, the other bills have been taken care of, and correct me if I'm wrong, we've passed out 2726A, with Lori Montes Anderson being the carrier on that. The chair is carrying 2662A. Senator Cruz is carrying 2678A. The chair is carrying 2797A. And we have notice of a minority report on that one. And I think that covers everything. Is that correct? Thank you very much. So we're going to adjourn today. Gentlemen and ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we're adjourned until our next meeting, which I believe is next Tuesday. And what time do we have that set for?
8:30.
All right, so we'll be here May 31st, 2011 at 8:30. Thank you.